I'm Marita Litauer. In collaboration with the release of our new online personality profile, I wanted to make my mother's classic presentation on the personalities available for everyone. If you're already familiar with Florence Litauer's work on understanding yourself and getting along with others, I am confident this recording will serve as a great refresher that you will want to share with your friends, family, and coworkers. If you are new to The Personalities, I hope this fast-paced and funny speech, recorded back in the 1990s, will introduce you to the vast body of work my mother and I developed over the past 50 years. Regardless of your previous relationship with the topic, I trust that listening to The Best of Personality Plus will be both enjoyable and enlightening. Please take the next step. Go to thepersonalities.com. There, you will find our entire collection of resources on the topic and a link that will take you directly to the new online personality profile. Please feel free to spread this classic message on all your social media outlets. Now, enjoy Florence Litauer addressing The Best of Personality Plus.
Many of you who have heard me speak on personalities before have pretty much heard what I've done on the basic things on Personality Plus, and we have put the two sheets into your little packet that you have there in front of you tonight, that little pad of paper. Isn't that adorable? I thought that was the cutest little thing. I thought that was so clever. The committee has done a marvelous job this year in putting this together. And if you look in there, there's kind of a salmon-colored page, and there's also then a bright pink page. And these two are for you to use as a stimulus for your conversation tonight and with the people that you came in case they don't have anything to say. This will give you something to do, unless you're one of those who wants to come to retreat when nothing is said. And then if you want to just be silent, that's all right. But from the sound of most of you tonight, I think you want to have a good time. Now, as we're going to be looking at this tonight, and then at the area of our background and past on Sunday morning, let me share with you a few basic principles. Now, when Fred and I first got a handle on the idea that there were different personalities, we truly had no idea that there was somebody different. I grew up where everybody thought life should be fun. And I thought anybody who was worth anything laughed all the time. I thought, why get serious? Let's all just keep funny. So I grew up in this funny family with a funny father and two funny brothers, and there were four of us. And we were all sanguine, let's have fun, and a little choleric, which is do it my way now. And if you do it my way now, it will be fun. If you don't, it won't be. And so we grew up this way, and we thought everybody ought to have a good time in life. And then I married Fred. And I found out that Fred's biggest thrill was to make sure that he cut the coupons out on Thursday morning so he could save money when going to the grocery store. And he does that. In fact, one day he was so excited, he got double coupon day when they marked the coffee down, and he went in with all of his coupons, and they ended up paying him 7 cents to take the coffee home. Now, he was really thrilled over that. So I found out that Fred and I had different values about things. Those of you, several of you asked me if I was going to tell about the grapes. And even though many of you know that, I'll throw that in for those of you who don't, because I got a few requests. And this is a story that happened on our honeymoon. Now, you see, when we got married, I really thought all the books I'd read said that you're going to live happily ever after. That's what I thought. And so I got married. Overnight, I became stupid. Fred put me on a training program from which I've never graduated, and he started showing me how to do things. Now, I thought I was perfect already. I remember telling him, why do I need to be trained? I'm perfect. He said, you just think you're perfect. But he said, there's a lot of things wrong with you. Well, I found out right off on our honeymoon, as we were sitting there in Bermuda on a little patio looking out to the Atlantic Ocean, and I'm thinking euphorically that I'm going to live happily ever after. And as I'm doing that, they brought from the main lodge a large platter of fruit, and in the middle was a large bunch of grapes. Now, I looked at those grapes, and they looked so good to me, and I just love grapes. And so I was just pulling one off here and off there. People who are sanguine, we like to have fun with everything. We see personality in even grapes. And so here I was looking at these little grapes. Cute little chubby one, I'll eat him. Little puny one, I'll eat him. Get rid of him. Big fat one, he'll taste good. So I was going around eating all these little grapes. Here a grape, there a grape, everywhere a grape, grape. Having a wonderful time. Now, as I was doing this, I noticed that Fred was staring at me. Now, I don't know if you ladies have husbands who stare at you. It's better than having them beat you, but not much. So I looked at Fred and I said to him, I asked a question that I have asked who knows how many thousand times in the last 33 plus years. I said, am I doing something wrong, Fred? He answered in the way that only a melancholy can answer, because melancholies don't want to make life easy for you. They want to make it difficult. And so they don't answer your questions simply as you ask. They ask you something back in return. So I said, Fred, am I doing something wrong? He said, do you like grapes? I didn't think that had much to do with my question. And I said, well, yes, I do like grapes. He said, well, if you like grapes, then I assume you'd like to learn how to eat them properly. I had no idea there was a proper way to eat grapes. But for Fred, there was a proper way for everything. Fred has always done everything properly. So he said that there is a proper way to eat grapes. He said, what you do is you take out your nail clippers. Now, how many of you brought nail clippers on your honeymoon? I had no idea I was supposed to have nails. Oh, one lady did. Fred, go explain that to Fred. In fact, I think she's getting them out right now to show me. Is that what you're doing? I mean, if you have them, I mean, show Fred, he'll be thrilled, because we never found anybody yet that took them on their honeymoon. So as he told me this, he said, you take out your nail clippers. Well, I didn't have any, but Fred had them. Fred has everything in his pockets. If you ask him, he will show you. And in his pockets up top here, he has 9 pens. He has blue, black, and red in 3 different kinds of tips, which multiplied out is 9 pens. And he also carries a little flashlight so that he can attract waitresses in dark restaurants. So we always have these kind of things. He has several other things he keeps with him, including the grape clippers. Oh, dear. I thought he was out in the other room. Are you going to show them?
Yeah, well, you're making fun of me, so I thought they ought to see that it's not fun, it's true. I have 3 pens there, and I have some more pens there, and I do have a flashlight.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Here we were sitting there, get back to the grapes here. There we were sitting there on this little porch in Bermuda looking out at the Atlantic Ocean, and Fred is taking out his nail clippers to show me how to eat grapes properly. So I said, how do you do it? Well, he reached over and he put his hands, fingers around a little cluster of grapes, felt down to the main stem. As he did that, he cut it off with his nail clippers, put this little cluster in front of me and said, now eat those. I said, do they taste better that way? He said, it has nothing to do with the taste. I thought, then why in the world would we go to all this trouble if it has anything to do with the taste? He said, it has nothing to do with the taste. It's to preserve the shape of the bunch. I didn't know we cared how that bunch looked. I mean, I sure didn't care, but Fred cared. I looked around to see if there were any grape judges hidden in the bushes. Seeing none, I asked Fred what difference it made, and he said, well, we need to keep the bunch in a beautiful shape. And he said, the way that you eat the grapes, plucking them willy-nilly all over the place any old way, he said, after a while, you look over, and you'll see there's all these little ugly brown stems sticking up. So I looked over there. Sure enough, there were little ugly brown stems sticking up. And I looked at those, I was amazed. Well, I found out right there, I'd only been married 2 days, and I found out that I had to do everything properly. We went home from our honeymoon, and we went out to a movie one night, and on the way back, I said, could we have an ice cream cone? And Fred said, no. I said, why not? He said, it's not on my schedule. I said, what schedule? He said, well, I have a schedule. I make it out every morning at 7 o'clock. And he said, from here on, if you wish to have ice cream at 11 o'clock at night, you tell me at 7 in the morning when I make out my schedule. Oh, and I can tell you're with me. I said to him, I did not know at 7 o'clock this morning that I wanted ice cream at 11 o'clock tonight. Now, you see, we had only been married 2 weeks, and we could not eat grapes or ice cream without a marriage problem. Now, I don't know what's got you hung up in your problems in life, but for us, we did not understand that there was even a possibility that someone who didn't think like us could possibly be right. So in our 15 years of a deteriorating marriage, during which time we both went our own way, and it tells us in the Bible, all we like sheep have gone astray, we've gone each one to our own way. And that's what I had done. I'd gone off my way, Fred had gone off his way, and by the time we'd been married 15 years, there wasn't a lot of real relationship left in our marriage. Today, as we counsel couples and individuals with problems, we find out that we really weren't that unusual, that there are a lot of people sitting right here tonight that have got that kind of a marriage, that it's a marriage you're not killing each other, but frankly, if he didn't come home for 2 or 3 days, you'd be a lot better off. And so we were just kind of in that type of a position where we weren't really too happy with each other. We weren't miserable because both of us went out and did our own thing. And if we did enough things, we could get along together. So this is somewhat the way we were going. For those of you who know my life story, know that I did have 2 daughters. Marita's here tonight. Lauren will be here tomorrow. And I did, after that, have 2 sons, both of whom were fatally brain damaged, and one died at 2, and one lived to be 19, died at the age of 19, the same size he was when he was 1 year old. Now, for someone like me who wanted to have happiness and fun, for someone who wanted to have everything enjoyable in life, it was more than I could possibly imagine that there was any way I could ever smile again. And as I was in a deep depression at that particular time, nobody talked about depression then. Nobody talked about problems. We just kept quiet and tried not to let anybody know what had happened to us. To have a retarded child in those days was considered a real blot on the family, and both my mother and my mother-in-law spent a great deal of effort and time trying to prove that it certainly couldn't have been inherited from their side. Now, as we went through this, it was tragic enough without that kind of a thing happening. As we went through this, Fred and I drifted even further apart. Sometimes tragedies bring people together. More often, they take them apart. And the figure is somewhere estimated between 70% and 80% of all couples who have give birth to a brain-damaged child of some type have at least marriage problems, if not divorce. So I guess as we look back on it, that we did as well as anyone else did under that situation. It was at that point in our life, after having these 2 children that were of no use whatsoever, that could not see or hear, that at that point that Fred and I, as we wondered, was there any point in staying together at all, that we at separate times prayed and asked that the Lord would come into our lives. Now, we'd both been brought up in churches. I had been in church all my life. I had won a lot of Bibles for prizes. I had memorized scripture. I'd done all those good little girl things in church. Fred had belonged to one of the major cults and had been involved in a group that told him he was perfect, which made it very difficult for me to argue with that. He had God on his side. So as at that point, we had drifted so far apart. But each one of us at one time or another, me and a Christian women's club and Fred and a little church we began to go to, at one point realized that just on our own, there was not much hope for us to pull this marriage together or anything else in life. And we both prayed and asked that the Lord Jesus would come into our lives and change us. Now, I'm sure there are many of you here tonight that have could tell stories of when you were first introduced to the Lord in some way where it was meaningful, not just going to church, but in some way where it became meaningful in your life. And those of you that have not, I hope throughout the weekend that you will pick up from us as we speak how important it is that at some point we dedicate our lives and say, Lord, here I am. Take me. Do with me as you will. Now, as I prayed that, it was right after that that we became aware of the different kinds of personalities. And as we began to look at these, and I found out that it was all right for Fred to be like he was, and I began to look at some of his differences as strengths instead of weaknesses, that we began for the first time in our married lives of 15 years to put things back together. And as we began to teach this, we first place learned it, and then we began to teach it. And for those of you that know me, you know that anything I know, I teach. I mean, if I know 2 new things, I run out and start a new seminar, because I don't want to waste anything. I want to tell it to everybody I know. So as soon as I possibly can, I start teaching. So Fred and I, back now 20 years ago, we invited some people into our home on Friday night for somewhat like a parlor game. And we asked them to come over, and we gave them out some standards similar to what you have in your hand tonight. And we asked them to check off different strengths and weaknesses that were like them and see if they could figure out what kind of a personality they had, because we had enjoyed doing this. The amazing thing was that as we sat there in our living room, knowing nothing except having one little chart, that we found out right before our eyes that couples began to look at each other and say, that's why you're like that. I never knew why you did that. I thought you were peculiar. I didn't understand you at all. And as we began to listen to them, we found out that with us not even knowing much, we were able to help other people to begin to understand their marriage and their families. So then they asked, could they come back the next week? So we said, sure, come back another week. I always like parties. My sanguine type like parties. So I said, come back next week. And they did. The next week, Fred divided us up. He wanted to get this thing organized, take the fun out of it. So he divided the thing up, and he said that what we would do the next week is that all of the sanguines, that's the ones who want to have fun, the sanguines, and that I was with them, all go into the bedroom, and we could go over this list of strengths and weaknesses, and we could give examples to see if this fit. We were really just testing the whole thing at that time. So we went off into the bedroom. Well, if you've ever seen a group of sanguines get together, I mean, we've got so much to say. We had so many stories to tell. We loved each other so much, and we had such a great, great time that at the end of the hour that Fred had allotted for us to go over these 20 things, when he came in to tell us it was the end of the hour, we all shrieked together, oh, where did the time go? We had no idea that it was that late. And as we looked at this, we also realized that we had only gotten through 3 out of the whole list. Now, Fred, with his melancholies, they were all in the living room. Now, melancholies, they can really plot out time. They have a good feel for it. I have to keep looking at it because I never quite know. Plus, I can't even read this watch. But the melancholies, they always know what time it is. They're very into time and dates and months and all those things that most of us sanguines don't care a lot about. And then we went in the family room where we had left the phlegmatics. Now, the phlegmatics, they're the easygoing type. They don't want to get too into anything or too involved. They want to stay calm, cool, and collected, peaceful, take it easy. So we went in the family room, and they were all asleep. Fred asked them, well, what did you do in here? Because he'd given them instructions. And they said, well, we all looked at the chart, and we decided that we would read it silently. Can you believe that? So they'd gone through it silently, gone to sleep, and that was the end of that. So the next week, we imported one choleric. They're the directive type that want to take charge and run everything. So we brought in one of them the next week to babysit with the phlegmatics, and it worked out just fine. So we did this for many weeks, and we found out how much fun it was. Now, tonight, as we look at this, I'm just going to be able to give you a framework, an idea by which you can begin to examine yourself. And as you do this, think first of what you were like as a child, because each one of these different temperaments is a birth personality. It's one that you are born with. You started out with some kind of a personality. Now, in years past, as I've been teaching this for the last 20 years, I have never found any proof, aside from my assumption, that all of us were born with a certain propensity in a certain direction, personality-wise. But recently, I've been very grateful that the University of Minnesota has just completed a study that they've been doing for years, and this is a study called Twins Reared Apart. And they took sets, in fact, 350 twins that had been separated at birth, identical twins that had been separated at birth and had been adopted out to different families. And as this happened, they never saw each other again, they had no contact with each other, and they had never lived with their birth mother or father. Now, at the end of many years, they brought some of them back together, 350 of them back together, and they came up with an absolutely amazing bit of evidence that 60% of our personality is inherited. How did they come up with that? They put these people together and compared them. They walked the same. They talked the same. They had the same kind of sense of humor. They had the same kind of a voice. Many of the men had married women of the same name. They had children. They'd named the same thing. In one case, they have a picture here of two men. They had bought the same make car, the same year car, and had bought it in the same month. I mean, they were unbelievable similarities as they put these people back together. Now, I have several articles here on the same subject, so that any of you'd like to see any of the facts, you certainly may. And as I began to study this, I realized this is the proof that I've been looking for to say that we know, according to this, in this test, that we are born with a certain kind of a personality. Now, if 60% of it's inherited, that leaves 40% for us parents to put upon these children. Do you realize that? So that if you don't like 40% of your child, it could be the 40% you gave him. And you can't really blame him. Maybe he got it from the way you trained him. Now, I have an adopted son who is 23 years old, and my adopted son, when he came to me, if we're using these facts correctly, as my son came to me, he had already a personality direction. Now, I know he did, because my son was very melancholy right from the beginning. The melancholy, as you see on your list, is deep and thoughtful and introspective, analytical. They are philosophical, poetic, musical. They have all the depths of life. And when I adopted little Fred, and I picked him up at the nursery, the lady said to me, the only thing we're concerned about with this child is the fact that he has never smiled. He is lying there in the crib. He was then 3 months old. He is lying there in the crib looking out as if he is analyzing all the rest of us. Now, see, I did not know anything about these personalities at the time, but I now, as I look back on that, I remembered that statement. And as I look back on it now, I realize that here was a melancholy child. So before he ever came into my house, before I ever had him at all, he had 60% of his personality had already been formed. Now, from that point on, environment makes a difference. And I know that had he been adopted into a different family, that he would be a different kind of a boy in some ways. But because he's been in our family, because he's learned from us in a family that's academically interested, that likes to have a good vocabulary, that wants to always be aggressive and doing something and meeting challenges, because of that, he's picked up some of our family nature. So as we look at this tonight, we're going to be seeing that the birth personality is what you and I started with. Now, I want you to be thinking between now and Sunday morning, when we look at some of the masks that some of us wear, hiding what we really started out to be, I'd like you to have already thought before, through, between now and then, about yourself. Think about what you were like as a child and see if you can remember which one of these children you were. Now, I'll give you the four terms again, and we've just put a simple little chart up here for those of you that can see it. I know over here you can't, but you can copy it down afterwards, and I'll give you private tutoring afterwards and get this all put together. Bob, I think you're a real problem, Bob. I'm sure I'll have to work with you a long time. We'll get together later while Emily's out with those boys in the elevator. So as we put this up here, this is just a simple kind of a chart to give you the feeling, and I'll give you the names, and you have them on your sheets. The sanguine and the choleric are both outgoing and optimistic. Choleric is the correct pronunciation. One lady told me she looked in four dictionaries trying to prove me wrong and ended up having to agree. So as we look at this, she was very choleric herself. They're argumentative and defensive. So as you look at this, the sanguine is the one who wants to have fun. You might write that at the top of your column, that the sanguine, their purpose is to have fun. Now, I can see some of you don't have pencils. Now, those of you who are melancholy have come prepared, I'm sure. Melancholies come with all kinds of pencils like Fred, rulers, flashlights, scotch tape, staplers. The only problem is that melancholies don't want anyone else touching their stuff, so you probably won't let them... If you melancholies could share a little with the sanguines, we're so lucky you sanguines even found your way to the room. Those of you who are choleric, you don't need to learn anything anyway because you just dragged all your dumb friends along. You're smart enough by yourself, so you don't need to learn much. I can see Jan Polhammer over there. I mean, she dragged a few of you over here tonight, did she? I can see that. And the phlegmatics, you don't need to take notes because you don't intend to change anyway. But those of you who would like to learn, those of you who would like to, you might take out a pencil and see if you could jot down a few things. The sanguine person wants to have fun. They want to have fun, and that's the way they're born. Now, those of you that are melancholy might already be saying to yourself, is it possible that God could have created 1/4 of all the people in the world to only want to have fun, to do nothing more serious than have fun? That's right. We find in our seminars, usually about 1/4 of them are sanguine. They want to have fun. Now, the cholerics, who are similar, they are outgoing and optimistic and people-oriented, but they want to have control. They want to be in charge of things. When I go around and travel to different churches, and I'm in from 2 to 5 churches a week, and as I travel around, I find out that in every church, there's usually some choleric lady who has the keys. The keys are somehow a sign of control. The pastor himself can't get a piece of paper unless she opens the cabinet for him because she's got everything under lock and key. Now, this is usually a choleric person who wants to have control. Now, the choleric person is the born leader. They're aggressive. They set goals quickly. They immediately see how things should be done. Now, both the choleric and the melancholy are organized people, but the choleric organizes immediately. The choleric is the one that walks in the room and says, all right, you three move there. You go over there. You do this, and we're going to be all right here. Now, that's the way the choleric moves. The choleric points a lot. You'll notice during some of our breaks that you will see people who will be pointing at others as they talk, letting the dummies know what they should be doing in life. So that's the choleric person. Now, the melancholy, those of you here that are melancholy, you are the deep ones. You are the ones that are organized, that brought everything, that analyze things correctly, that think deeply. You are the ones like my little son Fred, that when you were in the crib, you knew that the rest of those people really didn't have it all together. And you were analyzing all the others. The choleric one in the crib is the type, that little child that stands up in the crib, holds onto the edge, looks out and says to himself, how long before I can take this entire house away from mother? Now that's the choleric child's aim, to get control. And they know they will. The sanguine in the crib is looking out happy, bubbly, peeling the wallpaper off the wall, just doing fun things, having a great time. Now, the phlegmatic child is the easygoing one. This is the child that if you don't give him the bottle on time, won't scream. He'll just sit there and starve to death. I mean, he just won't even say anything. And so they are the calm, cool, collected, easygoing ones. As they grow up, they have that nice disposition that everybody loves. They have no obvious weaknesses. Nobody ever dislikes them. They get along with everybody. They're the all-purpose person of life. Now, when we look at these quickly, you can see that each one of us is born with a certain set of personality traits. One, some will be a blend of others, and we will, as we begin to think about it, go back to our childhood. Now, what were you like as a child? Let's think about that for a minute. What were you like? Were you the sanguine child? Were you the child like Marita that people, little children, would come to the door and they would knock on the door, and if Marita couldn't come out, there wasn't any point in playing? I mean, Marita had to be there. They wanted to have fun. And they would come in and say, can't Marita come out? Now, as Marita got older, she still had little groupies that followed her around. And I remember one night, we used to have a list of all the different jobs the children had to do. I put the list up on Thursday. Now, Fred made me do it, or I would never have done it. But he made me put this list up on Thursday. And the children could not go out Saturday until they had done all of their chores. So I remember this one particular Friday night, about midnight, I woke up, and I heard this noise in Marita's bathroom. So I went into Marita's bathroom. Here's this little strange blonde girl kneeling on the floor scrubbing the toilet. And I said to her, what are you doing? She said, well, Marita said she couldn't go to the beach with us tomorrow unless all of her work was done. So we've come over here in the night to do it for her. Now, see, that's sanguine. Only a sanguine can get little people to follow them around like that and do all their dirty work and to think they have a privilege to be able to do it. Now, that's only sanguine can do that. I have a little sanguine grandson. He's 5 years old. Little Jonathan. Jonathan is so sanguine. He stood out on the edge of the pool one day, and he looked up to the sky. He stood right there on the edge of the pool. He looked up, and he said, my mommy loves me. My daddy loves me. My grammy loves me. My papa loves me. Aunt Rita loves me. Uncle Chuck loves me. The whole world loves me. Now, see, that's sanguine. That is a sanguine child. I mean, that child thinks he's adorable. He is so cute. And I call little Randy, his melancholy brother, who's 9 today, and I call little Randy my special boy. So one day I said to Jonathan, I said, Jonathan, since I call Randy special, I think I'll call you adorable. He looked up, he said, I am both special and adorable. Now, see, this child is all set. I mean, he's cute, he knows it, he's ready to go on in life. He is going to have fun. He has the kind of personality that everybody is attracted to. Now, this is very difficult for Randy because he's very melancholy, and he's very deep and very quiet, and he plays the piano, and he plays the clarinet, and he studies, and he does his penmanship nicely. He does all the right things. Now, little Randy has all of the attributes of the melancholy, but sometimes he gets a little depressed with life. I took him to Carl's Jr.'s one day, and we were sitting there, and little Randy looked down at his hamburger. Now, he'd chosen where he wanted to go, and he looked down at his hamburger, and he said to me, Grammy, do you know what I don't like about this place? I mean, he's already kind of depressed. I said, what? He said, they don't even center the hamburger on the roll. You know what they do in this place? He said, first they just put down a roll, throw on the hamburger, plop on two pickles, put on this limp piece of lettuce. He said, and then they just drop this cover on the top of it, and they call this a hamburger. I looked at him, I said, Randy, I said, if you knew what was in a lot of the kitchens of some of these restaurants, you wouldn't eat anything. And I said, some of the places you wouldn't even go into. He said, well, Grammy, this is one of them. Now, see, he was already depressed about this. Then he started telling me about little Jonathan. He said, Jonathan is such a pest. He said he messes up everything. He does not even put the toys back in the boxes where they belong. Now, you can know, and this is Emily's credit here, that my daughter has got boxes. She's got more hours in my day, boxes. And she's got boxes everywhere. Her entire house is in Emily's boxes. And she's even got pictures. I don't know if you've done this, Emily. Pictures at the end of the toys so the children can put them all back in the right box. Any dummy that can't read can put all these things back in the boxes because she's got it so organized and so set up. So little Randy is saying to me, Jonathan does not even put the toys back in the right boxes. So he's very depressed over Jonathan. Then he said to me, you know, Grammy, there's one good thing about having this new baby brother. Because I have a new one. He's just 10 months old. And he said, you know, the good thing about having that little brother is that now Jonathan is going to find out what it's like to have a little brother to wreck his stuff. And then suddenly this terrible look came over him. He said to me, you know what I just thought of, Grammy? I said, what? He said, if Jonathan's got a little brother, that means I've got two of them. Oh, heaven, two of them. Almost more than he could handle. How early can you even talk about these things with children? I took Jonathan for a ride just a week ago. He's just five. We're driving down the freeway, and I said, Jonathan, I want to talk to you about your personality. He said, oh, good. Now, he's sanguine. He's all happy about this thing. And I said, now, Jonathan, you and I are sanguine. He said to me, sanguine. I said, that's right, sanguine. And I said, do you know what sanguine means? I said, sanguine is somebody who likes to have fun. He said, oh, I love to have fun. I said, that's right. Sanguines love to go to parties. He said, oh, I love parties. I love birthday parties. Parties are so much fun. Now, sanguines use that word fun a lot. And so he said, oh, that's so much fun. And I said, usually we have fun and we have a good sense of humor and we can say funny things. He said, oh, I love funny things. So we go over this a while and I said, now, not only are you sanguine, and am I sanguine, but Aunt Marita is sanguine, too. He said, oh, I'm so glad I like Aunt Marita. And I said, that's right, we're all sanguine. I said, now, your brother Randy is melancholy. He said, melancholy. I said, that's right. I said, that means that Randy likes to put his toys in the right boxes. He said, oh, yes, he tries to make me do that, too. So I go over a few melancholy attributes with him, and I said that, and melancholies like pens. And he said, oh, Randy loves pens. In fact, we know that Randy has inherited something from his papa because he got in trouble at school for spending too much time in the school store buying pens. So here I said, not only is Randy melancholy and likes pens, but Papa is melancholy too, and he likes pens. He said, oh, yes, Papa's got lots of pens. I said, that's right. And I said, and Uncle Chuck is melancholy too. So I got through this whole thing, and he repeated them back to me. I taught him the lesson. He repeated it back to me, got all done, and he said, yes. And he said, Randy and Papa and Uncle Chuck are all melancholy. And then he leaned over to me in the car, and he said, Grammy, let's not tell them. I see, he got a handle on this whole thing very quickly at a very young age. Now, that's what we want to look at as we're together. We want to be able to talk about it conversationally. We want to begin to look at what were you like as a child. Were you like little Jonathan, want to have a good time all the time, a lot of fun? Were you like Randy, want to put the toys in the boxes, get everything lined up, have all the pens perfect, do your job well? Were you choleric like Lauren was when she was a child and wanted to tell everybody what to do? When she was in nursery school, the teacher called up and and said, I never have to worry if I can't come to school because Lauren could run the entire place on her own. So now that was when she was 4 years old. She could run the entire nursery school. She has always been choleric. Now, you'll notice the one thing that we didn't have in our family, since Marita and I are sanguine, and Lauren's choleric, and Fred is melancholy, and my son is melancholy, what we didn't have any of was these nice, peaceful people that do what you tell them. We didn't have any of those. So we had to import one, so Lauren married one for us. So we were able to get a nice, peaceful one, my son-in-law, Randy, who collects stamps and coins, and it takes a phlegmatic to sit there and paste those little stamps in those little spots day after day after day. So we have now a phlegmatic in our family. And Marita nicely married a melancholy, and Chuck and Marita are sanguine melancholy, and Lauren and Randy are choleric and phlegmatic, so that they did exactly right. They married opposites, just as we have found out they do, so that I would have good examples. So as we look at our family, I can tell you what we are, and then you can think about it in your family. Now, what were you like as a child? Were you the sanguine that wanted to have fun? Were you the choleric one, tell everybody what to do? Were you the melancholy one to get deeply into things and do it perfectly? Were you the phlegmatic that didn't care where you went, whatever everybody says, that's okay, you'll just fit in, blend with the group, be that nice all-purpose person? Which one were you as a child? Now, we've given you a whole list of different attributes and weaknesses that you can look over. In the Bible, it tells us in many, many places consistently, it says, let a man examine himself. Put yourself to the test. Judge me that I be not judged. Search me, O God. Know my ways. If there be any offensive way in me, then lead me in the way everlasting. So Scripture is consistent. Find out why we are the way we are. And that's what we want to do. So in the framework we're giving you tonight, think about yourself as a child. Now, when you see some of the different lists of characteristics that are there, let me share a few of them with you. I'll give you one for each one of the groups. The sanguine person I've told you about as a child. Now, a sanguine person is one who loves to tell stories. They like to talk. They always have something to say. They can take any insignificant, trivial fact in life and make a story out of it. I mean, they can make anything into some grandiose production. I once lost my car in a 7-story parking garage in New Haven, Connecticut. And I came out from shopping holding all of my Christmas bundles, looked at the 7-story garage, and said to myself, where in the world is my car? How many of you have ever lost a car? Oh, a wonderful group here tonight. Oh, yes, take note of that, Bob. All those people have lost cars, just so I don't look quite so bad. So I stood there looking at this garage, wondering how in the world I was going to find my car. And as I was doing this, sanguine women have a helpless look they can throw on, like, oh. So I just kind of stood there looking helpless. And when we do this, there's always some man comes along and says, what's your problem, honey? So I said to him, well, I have lost my car in that 7-story parking garage. He said, you've what? I said, I've lost my car in the 7-story parking garage. He said, well, what kind of a car is it? I said, well, that's a problem, because I don't know what kind of a car it is. He said, you don't know what kind of a car you drive? I said, and worse than that is the fact we have two cars, and I don't know which one I brought. Well, this poor man looked at me. He said, you don't know which one you drove? I said, no. He said, well, you do need help. I said, that's right, I do need help. So he said, why don't you look for your keys? Now, if a sanguine loses something as big as a car, do we know what keys are? So I started feeling around, where are my keys, looking around, and I had a large sanguine handbag. Is there anyone here who's got a large sanguine handbag? I made a large sanguine. Oh, that's wonderful. Oh, hold that up. That's a nice large one. It's a little drab for sanguines. Oh, that's better. Oh, I like that one. Look, oh, stand up and hold that. I love that one. Look at that, the hugest handbag I've ever seen. Oh, that has to win the prize. I mean, that is a sanguine handbag. You got some cute things in there, I assume? Yeah, sanguines have all kinds of stuff in there. Now, you that are melancholy, you carry little handbags. We got a little melancholy handbag down here somewhere. Melancholies have nice little neat handbags. Everything, oh, you got a nice little box one there. Oh, yeah, let me see yours. This is like a filing cabinet, this lady's got. Oh, that's very good. And it's black, too. Melancholies usually have black handbags. So, as you look at these black and little handbags, those are melancholy ones because you know where you're going, so you don't have to carry everything you own, right? But you see, with a sanguine, we never know where we're going in a given day. So we just line that handbag up every morning against the kitchen counter and sweep everything right into it. And as we do that, we've got a lot of stuff in there. But we're prepared for anything, right? Extra pair of shoes, whatever it is we need. So here I am, standing there on the curb with my big handbag, fishing through there, trying to get all of these things out of there. And as I'm fishing through, I realize that I can't do that standing up, so I hand the man all of my bundles. Now, this man is now committed. He's into this thing. So there he is, and I kneel down on the floor, and I start emptying out my handbag on the curbstone. Now, I'm right there in the gutter, emptying it out on the curbstone. Now, those of us that are sanguine, you tell me, when we've got someone standing there holding our bundles and we're taking things out of our handbag, what do we feel led to do for this man? Entertain him, of course. We've got to keep him happy. So everything I find, I say, oh, I haven't seen that in ages. So this man is standing there looking down at me. Pretty soon, another man came along. He says to the first man, what's the lady doing in the gutter? And he said, well, she's trying to find the keys to her car because she lost her car in the seven-story parking garage. He said, what kind of a car is it? He said, she doesn't know. He said, you mean she doesn't know what kind of a car she doesn't know? She doesn't know. He said, oh, she does need help. So he joined in. So the man gave him half the bundles. So now we got two men here with bundles, and I'm still going through my handbag having a wonderful time. Pretty couple ladies came along. They joined in. And pretty soon I did find the keys in the bottom, and so I gave them to the man, but I had both sets, so it didn't help. So the ladies helped me put some of the stuff back into the handbag, and I stood up, and I started telling them, describing the cars. One is yellow with a little roof that goes up and down, and the other one is long navy blue and velour seats. So with that kind of information, we started through the garage. You have no idea, if you haven't done this, how many lonely people stand around in garages waiting for attention. Why, as we wandered through that garage, we picked up a lot of people. I mean, fun-loving people. And by the time we got to the car, we had 10 or 12 people. I was ready to start a club and be president. And see, this was a fun time. Now, I went home and told Fred that story. Now, wouldn't you think, since you laughed at the story, I mean, wouldn't you think Fred would find that just adorable? I went home and I told Fred that story. And I told it to him with all kinds of expression. I had even more details than you, and grateful I forgot some of them. And so as I told this whole story to him, I got all through, and at the end he said to me, I am so humiliated to be married to any woman so stupid as to lose her car in a seven-story parking garage. And he then gave me a little lesson about how, he said, don't you know those architects had you in mind when they made that garage? I said, no, I didn't even know they knew me. He said, that's why they wrote those numbers up on the wall. It says there's numbers up there, that means a level, and then there's letters, and that means a section. He said, now the next time you get there, you take out your pencil and paper. Now, where's the problem there? I don't have any pencil and paper. I've told this story, and I've told this story for years. It's a true story. It happened in New Haven. I went back a couple years ago and looked at the garage and the whole thing just to review in my mind that it was there and it was accurate. I've had so many people come up and tell me stories about how they lost their cars. One lady, she called the police because she went out at the end of work and her car was gone, a 67 Dodge, and it was gone, gold Dodge. So she called the policeman, and the policeman came, took down all the reports. She said, will you drive me home now? And so, because I don't have my car. So the policeman said, yes, he drove her home. And he drives into the driveway. He said to her, how many 67 gold Dodges do you have? She said, only one. Why? He said, well, there's one sitting right there. In true sanguine style, she looked up and said, oh, I totally forgot my girlfriend drove me to work this morning. The policeman was thrilled. Another lady came up and told me a story. She said that she's saying when her husband called up and said he's bringing home some client for dinner, and would she get something ready so that they could have dinner ready when he arrived. And so as the client came in, they went into the living room, the husband and the man, they sat down, and she started putting things together for the dinner. She realized she was missing a key ingredient. Sanguines are always missing a key ingredient. They always have to go to the store. Marita has been known to go to the store three times on one preparation. So they, because she only reads as far as she's gone in the recipe. I mean, you don't want to get too far ahead in this whole thing. I can see there is some really, this is really a sanguine group here tonight. Can I have another half hour? So this lady went off to the store, and she, as she walked out the door to get in her car, she realized that the client's car was behind hers. in the driveway. And she didn't want to go in the living room and tell them that she needed to move his car because her husband would be embarrassed. So she decided, she looked, and here were the client's keys sitting there on the right on the table in the hall. So she decided, I'll take his keys, and he'll never know I've even borrowed the car. So off she goes in the client's car. And she goes in and does whatever she needs, comes out to get into the car. Now, she's got the keys. She has no idea what kind of a car it is. No idea what kind of a car or even what lane she parked it in. She didn't know anything about the client's car. And here she is with whatever the ingredient is and the keys. She doesn't know how to find the car. But she told me, she said, suddenly it dawned on me that the one thing I knew about the car was that it had a letter on the front seat addressed to the man. She said, the reason I knew it was there is because I had read it. Sanguines like to see everything. So she went up and down the aisles looking in cars till she found one that had a letter on the front seat. So she then went back home and she put the keys down. Nobody knew she'd done this. And she fixed up the meal and everything was fine. But she said that her husband and this man were such dull company. She said they just sat there and there were no laughs during dinner at all. So finally she felt led to tell them this whole story. Now you can imagine how that went over. Her husband was humiliated and mortified, and the client was furious. He never let anybody into that car at all, and he was wild that not only had she taken his car without permission, but she had read his letter that was on the front seat. Now, see, this lady was in real trouble from her cute fun and games. And then just one more. I have maybe 10 or 15 of these people have told me, just do one more. This is one of my favorite ones, that a lady came and told me that she had left her car, that she had left it there, gone shopping for the whole day, came out, she couldn't find the car. The car was indeed gone. So she went to the security man, and I don't know if you know how much work those security men do finding our cars for us, but they drive around all day with little ladies who have lost cars. So this man drove up and down all the aisles trying to find the lady's car. At least she knew what kind of a car it was, and drove all around trying to find the car. Couldn't find it. So he said, we'll come back. I'll meet you back here at 9 o'clock tonight, and we'll look when all the rest of the cars are gone. So they did that at night. No cars. Then hers wasn't there. No car for her at all. So they made out the police report, and they figured out what to do. They sent in for the insurance claim. She got the insurance money. She went out and she bought herself a new car, and now she's driving around town in the new car, and she is happy. So this is even better than the old one, and she's so thrilled. And then one day, some 6 weeks down the line, she gets a phone call from Sears, and they say, when are you going to come and pick up your car that you had the tires rotated on? Enough. You got the drift of the sanguine, right? All right, the choleric. The drift of the choleric. As an adult, the choleric wants to straighten everybody out and take care of all your problems. I can remember Emily telling me one day, Emily, you may have noticed, a little choleric, and Emily said to me one day, she was with a group of her friends, and they came out of some meeting, and they were standing on a street corner, and they were trying to figure out where to go for lunch. Now, the sanguine always has cute ideas. The sanguine, oh, I want to go to that restaurant where the waitresses have little fluffy things all around here, and the meshy stockings, and they have the hair all pulled up, big flowers up here. They want to go to that restaurant. So then you say, where is that restaurant, or what's the name? Oh, well, I don't know where it is. All right, so that wipes out the sanguine. All right, now the melancholies know where all the restaurants are. However, melancholies are not free with their information. So they will not just tell you, they will only tell you if you ask them. So they are standing there with all of this information cataloged in the file drawers of their mind, but they aren't going to tell you unless you happen to ask. Now, the phlegmatics don't care where they eat. Whatever, it's all right. Whatever the gang wants to do, they'll go along with it. Doesn't make too much difference. And so Emily, while they're all there trying to mull this over, Emily went in, quickly called the restaurant down the street, made a reservation for the 12 of them, came back out. They didn't even know she was missing. And then she said, you six get in this car, you six get in this car. We're going down to this restaurant and have a reservation. Let's get going. We're going to move. And so as they all move immediately into these two cars, one of them says, I guess we'll just have to do what little Emily tells us. They see the cholerics can tell everybody what to do very, very quickly. We also, I'm half choleric, half sanguine, half choleric, and the choleric, especially if you combine sanguine choleric, we love to talk, and we also want to direct everything and correct all the wrongs of life. So we talk in almost shorthand. because we do not need to finish sentences. I mean, you start a sentence, I know what you're going to say. You don't need to finish that. I go right into mine. Now, you know what I'm going to say. You go right into yours. Then I overlap you with that, and here we are going like this, and we're up here talking as fast as we can on top of each other. One day, Marilyn Murray, my friend Marilyn, and I both sang when college. We were standing together at a retreat where we were speaking, and I'm standing there with Marilyn, and we are talking this way. We are overlapping back and forth like this, talking away, having a wonderful time. Her sister Mary Sue pulled up between us. Now, I noticed Mary Sue was there, but we were in the middle of an important conversation. However, since we're Christian speakers, we have to be polite, so I just nodded like this. And a nod like that while still talking, what that says is, I see you, honey, but I have no time for you. That's what it says. So I kind of look over at her like this. And as I look over her, I notice that her collar is standing up crooked. So while still talking to Marilyn, I reach over and flatten down Mary Sue's collar. Now, while I'm flattening down her collar, I notice that Marilyn is brushing lint off her shoulder. Now, see, Marilyn and I have not yet had time to say hello to Mary Sue, and we are straightening her out. Now, those of you who are choleric know, if you're sitting in a restaurant, and there is a lady at the next table who's got the tag sticking out of the back of her blouse, what is it that you that are choleric have to do? You've got to go see it. You don't even stop and think about it. You don't think, does she want me to do that? You don't think about it. You just march right over there, put your cold hand right down the strange lady's back, right down the back. And as you do that, according to their temperament, they'll respond differently. When you do that to a sanguine, what will they say? Oh, is that you? Oh. You'll be just all happy about it. You make friends, join us, and we have a nice little party over it. If you do it to another choleric who's practical kind of person, what'll they do? Say, thank you, that's good. I appreciate you doing that, that's fine. That's it. Now, if you do it to a phlegmatic, they'll just say, oh, I didn't know it was out. Okay, thank you, kind of adjust a little bit. But now, what if you do it to a melancholy? Oh, what does the melancholy start to think? Oh, dear, where have I been? Who has seen me like this? Oh, they will never like me again. Oh, dear, the world is over. It's done. Now, see, according to their personalities, they will respond very differently to the type of things that you do. So the choleric is the one that's pushing in there, correcting the wrong, straightening things out, taking care of everything in life. Now, the melancholy person, we've looked at that, and Fred is the melancholy. The melancholy wants everything done correctly. They want it done perfectly. Now, Fred has all of his jackets lined up in his closet, and they're all lined up in order. And when he takes the jacket off tonight, he puts it at the far right, and it works its way systematically down the line. And then in the morning, he takes one off of the left. And the next night it goes back on the right. You see this system we've got down here, how well everything goes? It's so exciting. And one lady told me, her melancholy husband, that he even ties the bows on his shoes before he puts them in the closet, so there won't be any loose strings. Isn't that good? Another lady told me that her husband has got a chart. Melancholies like charts. Her husband has got a chart. And he writes down, every time he buys a pair of shoes, he writes down the date that he buys the shoes, how much money it costs, and then he puts a check beside it every day that he wears those shoes until he throws them away. And then, of course, you can see, you that are melancholy can clearly see that all you have to do is divide the number of times you wore the shoes into the amount of money it costs. You come up with the per day amount, and she told me the last pair he'd done was 9 cents a day. Now, that's pretty cheap, I think, when you get right down to it. 9 cents a day. So this man had kept track of that. Another lady told me her husband dates all the light bulbs before he puts them in so that when they go out, he can see and keep a chart on how many months these have lasted. Now, you see, the melancholies get into these things, get detail conscious. They want everything to be perfect. Now, the phlegmatic, the easygoing type, is the one that does not want to get involved in conflict. They would rather do it your way than have you not like them. They would like to get along as easily as possible, and they're easy to get along with because they won't fight with you at all. They do have trouble making decisions, and my phlegmatic mother used to really be overwhelmed when I would take her to Baskin-Robbins 31 flavors. However, she found a way to get over that because she came up with a solution. What did she always order? Vanilla, a good phlegmatic flavor. That's right. Buy vanilla, because that way you have no decisions to make, and it's easy, and it can't possibly be offensive. Now, one of the phlegmatics that you all know of is the ex-president Gerald Ford. And he is a phlegmatic. In fact, I just heard him the other day on television, and somebody said, why is it that they are doing a television special about your wife's life instead of your life? And he said, well, frankly, hers has been much more interesting. I thought, wasn't that a phlegmatic answer? I really am. And she just got a lot more going for her than I do. Now, as a phlegmatic president, he was a man who was chosen for his hour, because at that time, what was it we did not want in temperament at that point? We did not want, as somebody was going to come up with some new hot ideas, we wanted everything to be simmered down and kept calm, cool, and collected. And so Ford was chosen, a man for his hour, a phlegmatic, just the kind of person we wanted in there at that particular time. Now, as we look at the political scene, we can see that we had Ford in there as a phlegmatic president. In fact, when he finished, and the Wall Street Journal had an article, and it said in there that they are trying to build a monument to ex-President Ford. It was after he was out of office. And it said that they were having trouble figuring out what kind of a monument to build. And it said in the paper, because how do you build a monument to something that didn't happen? Then it went on to say, however, and this was the Wall Street Journal article, it said, however, during his time, there were no wars, there were no problems, and it went through all the things that there weren't. It said we didn't have great international conflagrations. It went all the things that we did not have. And then it said, which may mean that they should give him the biggest and best memorial of them all, because nothing went wrong. And right this week, how grateful we would be if nothing had gone wrong. As they were giving out the Tower report yesterday morning, the people that they were giving the report were talking about both Reagan, who is sanguine, and about Carter, who is melancholy, and they made a statement yesterday morning that I thought was so true, even though they didn't use these terms. And they said that Reagan's style is a hands-off style, that he just wants to relax and have the image and have the grand scheme and let somebody else take care of the details. That's sanguine. And it said, in contrast, when Carter was in, he got so into the details that he couldn't see the grand scheme. Now, isn't it amazing that we are born with different personalities? That from what we start out, we continue that way along in life unless something happens to mask it, which we'll look at on Sunday morning. And so as we think of this tonight, I'd like you to be asking yourself, what kind of a personality did I start out to be? What did God intend me to be? What kind of a person did he want? What kind of strengths have I got, and what kind of weaknesses have I got? And as you spend some time in conversation about this, I'm sure from the things that we've said tonight, just in this brief time, that you can get a handle on this in such a way that you can find out who you are and who it is that God intended you to be. Let's close our time in prayer. Our Father, we're so grateful tonight that we can all be here. And Lord, I know that you've commanded each one of us to examine ourselves and find out what kind of a person you intended us to be. And Lord, as we think about this tonight and as we talk with our friends about it, may we have a real understanding, a complete revelation as to what it is you want us to be and do in life. And Lord, as you make this clear to us, that we will be able then to relate better with those other people, those slightly irregular people who aren't just like you and me. Now, as I ask, Lord, tonight, as each one of us in our hearts asks, that you would give us the wisdom to know how to find ourselves, that, Lord, if there's someone here tonight that's come lonely, perhaps not even knowing who they are or even having an understanding of what it is to be a believing Christian, that you might work in their life, that we could just quietly in our hearts right now just say, as I did that day at that Christian Women's Club, and if there's any insecurity in our hearts, and say, Lord Jesus, come in. Come in and change me. Open my eyes, open my heart. Make me the kind of person that you want me to be. And we pray this in Jesus' precious name. Amen and amen. Thank you. It's been a true delight. Sorry I went over, but you were so good I couldn't help it.
Thanks for listening. This presentation was given at a women's conference that I organized. At that conference, my mother, Florence Littauer, was scheduled to give a long, more in-depth teaching on the personalities on Saturday. For the Friday night opening message, I asked her to just share the funniest stories from each personality type. My goal was to send the ladies to their rooms discussing their personality and that of their friends, family, and co-workers so they'd arrive Saturday morning ready for more. I hope that after listening to The Best of Personality Plus, you too are ready for more. Please go to thepersonalities.com. You can start by taking your online personality profile. If you are more of a reader, I suggest you purchase my mother's bestseller, Personality Plus, or mine, Wired That Way. Both books are available free to Kindle Unlimited members. If you are more of a listener, please check out the classic 4-CD set from my mother, also titled Personality Plus, or my single session recording titled Wired That Way. For small group use, there's also a 10-session DVD series that features both my mother and myself, with a cameo from my sister. Again, thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this presentation as much as listeners in the past, please help me share it far and wide.